Welcome to Getting Things Done. Welcome to a goldmine of insights into strategies for how to have more energy, be more relaxed, and get a lot more accomplished with much less effort. If you're like me, you like getting things done and doing them well. Yet you also want to savor life in ways that seem increasingly elusive, if not downright impossible, if you're working too hard. This doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. It is possible to be effectively doing while you're delightfully being in your ordinary workaday world. I think efficiency is a good thing. Maybe what you're doing is important, interesting, or useful, or maybe it isn't, but it has to be done anyway. In the first case, you want to get as much return as you can on your investment of time and energy. In the second, you want to get on to other things as fast as you can without any nagging loose ends. And whatever you're doing, you'd probably like to be more relaxed, confident that whatever you're doing at the moment is just what you need to be doing, that having a beer with your staff after hours, gazing at your sleeping child in his or her crib at midnight, answering the email in front of you, or spending a few informal minutes with the potential new client after the meeting is exactly what you ought to be doing as you're doing it. Teaching you how to be maximally efficient and relaxed whenever you need or want to be was my main purpose in writing this book. I have searched for a long time, as you may have, for answers to the questions of what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And after 20-plus years of developing and applying new methods for personal and organizational productivity, alongside years of rigorous exploration in the self-development arena, I can attest that there is no single once-and-for-all solution. No software, seminar, cool personal planner, or personal mission statement will simplify your workday or make your choices for you as you move through your day, week, and life. What's more, just when you learn how to enhance your productivity and decision-making at one level, you'll graduate to the next accepted batch of responsibilities and creative goals, whose new challenges will defy the ability of any simple formula or buzzword du jour to get you what you want, the way you want to get it. But if there's no single means of perfecting personal organization and productivity, there are things we can do to facilitate them. As I have personally matured from year to year, I've found deeper and more meaningful, more significant things to focus on and be aware of and do. And I've uncovered simple processes that we can all learn to use that will vastly improve our ability to deal proactively and constructively with the mundane realities of the world. What follows is a compilation of more than two decades worth of discoveries about personal productivity, a guide to maximizing output and minimizing input, and to doing so in a world in which work is increasingly voluminous and ambiguous. I've spent many thousands of hours coaching people in the trenches at their desk, helping them process and organize all of their work at hand. The methods I've uncovered have proved to be highly effective in all types of organizations at every job level, across cultures, and even at home and school. After 20 years of coaching and training some of the world's most sophisticated and productive professionals, I know the world is hungry for these methods. Executives at the top are looking to instill ruthless execution in themselves and their people as a basic standard. They know, and I know, that behind closed doors after hours, there remain unanswered calls, tasks to be delegated, unprocessed issues from meetings and conversations, personal responsibilities unmanaged, and dozens of emails still not dealt with. Many of these business people are successful because the crises they solve and the opportunities they take advantage of are bigger than the problems they allow and create in their own offices and briefcases. But given the pace of business and life today, the equation is in question. On the one hand, we need proven tools that can help people focus their energies strategically and tactically without letting anything fall through the cracks. On the other, we need to create work environments and skills that will keep the most invested people from burning out due to stress. We need positive work style standards that will attract and retain the best and brightest. We know this information is sorely needed in organizations. It's also needed in schools where our kids are still not being taught how to process information, how to focus on outcomes, or what actions to take to make them happen. And for all of us individually, it's needed so we can take advantage of all the opportunities we're given to add value to our world in a sustainable, self-nurturing way. The power, simplicity, and effectiveness of what I'm talking about in getting things done are best experienced as experiences in real time with real situations in your real world. Necessarily, the book must put the essence of this dynamic art of workflow management and personal productivity into a linear format. I've tried to organize it in such a way as to give you both the inspiring big picture view and a taste of immediate results as you go along. The book is divided into three parts. Part 1 describes the whole game, providing a brief overview of the system and an explanation of why it's unique and timely, and then presenting the basic methodologies themselves in their most condensed and basic form. Part 2 shows you how to implement the system. It's your personal coaching, step by step, on the nitty-gritty application of the models. Part 3 goes even deeper, describing the subtler and more profound results you can expect when you incorporate the methodologies and the models into your work and life. I want you to hop in. I want you to test this stuff out, even challenge it. I want you to find out for yourself that what I promise is not only possible, but instantly accessible to you personally. And I want you to know that everything I propose is easy to do. It involves no new skills at all. You already know how to focus, how to write things down, how to decide on outcomes and actions, and how to review options and make choices. You'll validate that many of the things you've been doing instinctively and intuitively all along are right. I'll give you ways to leverage those basic skills into new plateaus of effectiveness. I want to inspire you to put all this into a new behavior set that will blow your mind. Throughout the book, I refer to my coaching and seminars on this material. I've worked as a management consultant for the last 2 decades, alone and in small partnerships. My work has consisted primarily of doing private productivity coaching and conducting seminars based on the methods presented here. I and my colleagues have coached more than 1,000 individuals, trained hundreds of thousands of professionals, and delivered many hundreds of public seminars. This is the background from which I have drawn my experiences and examples. The promise here was well described by a client of mine who wrote, quote, "When I habitually applied the tenets of this program, it saved my life. When I faithfully applied them, it changed my life. This is a vaccination against the day-to-day firefighting, the so-called urgent and crisis demands of any given workday, and an antidote for the imbalance many people bring upon themselves." Unquote. Part 1, The Art of Getting Things Done. Chapter 1, A New Practice for a New Reality. It's possible for a person to have an overwhelming number of things to do and still function productively with a clear head and a positive sense of relaxed control. That's a great way to live and work at elevated levels of effectiveness and efficiency. It's also becoming a critical operational style required of successful and high-performing professionals. You already know how to do everything necessary to achieve this high-performance state. If you're like most people, however, you need to apply these skills in a more timely, complete, and systematic way so you can get on top of it all instead of feeling buried. And though the method and the techniques I describe in this book are immensely practical and based on common sense, most people will have some major work habits that must be modified before they can implement this system. The small changes required, changes in the way you clarify and organize all the things that command your attention, could represent a significant shift in how you approach some key aspects of your day-to-day work. Many of my clients have referred to this as a significant paradigm shift. The methods I present here are all based on 2 key objectives. First, capturing all the things that need to get done, now, later, someday, big, little, or in between, into a logical and trusted system outside of your head and off your mind. And second, disciplining yourself to make front-end decisions about all the inputs you let into your life so that you will always have a plan for next actions that you can implement or renegotiate at any moment. This book offers a proven method for this kind of high-performance workflow management. It provides good tips, tools, tricks, and techniques for implementation. As you'll discover, the principles and methods are instantly usable and applicable to everything you have to do in your personal as well as your professional life. You can incorporate, as many others have before you, what I describe as an ongoing dynamic style of operating in your work and in your world. Or, like still others, you can simply use this as a guide for getting back into better control when you feel you need to. The problem: new demands, insufficient resources. Almost everyone I encounter these days feels he or she has too much to handle and not enough time to get it all done. In the course of a single recent week, I consulted with a partner in a major global investment firm who was concerned that the new corporate management responsibilities he was being offered would stress his family commitments beyond the limits. And with a mid-level human resources manager trying to stay on top of her 150-plus email requests per day, fueled by the goal of doubling the company's regional office staff from 1,100 to 2,000 people in 1 year, all as she tried to protect a social life for herself on the weekends. A paradox has emerged in this new millennium. People have enhanced quality of life, but at the same time, they're adding to their stress levels by taking on more than they have resources to handle. It's as though their eyes were bigger than their stomachs. And most people are, to some degree, frustrated and perplexed about how to improve the situation. Work no longer has clear boundaries. A major factor in the mounting stress level is that the actual nature of our jobs has changed much more dramatically and rapidly than have our training for and our ability to deal with work. In just the last half of the 20th century, what constituted work in the industrial world was transformed from assembly line, make it and move it kinds of activity to what Peter Drucker has so aptly termed knowledge work. In the old days, work was self-evident. Fields were to be plowed, machines tooled, boxes packed, cows milked, widgets cranked. You knew what work had to be done. You could see it. It was clear when the work was finished or not finished. Now, for many of us, there are no edges to most of our projects. Most people I know have at least half a dozen things they're trying to achieve right now, and even if they had the rest of their lives to try, they wouldn't be able to finish these to perfection. You're probably faced with the same dilemma. How good could that conference potentially be? How effective could the training program be, or the structure of your executive's compensation package? How inspiring is the essay you're writing? How motivating the staff meeting? How functional the reorganization? And a last question, how much available data could be relevant to doing those projects better? The answer is an infinite amount, easily accessible, or at least potentially so, through the web. On another front, the lack of edges can create more work for everyone. Many of today's organizational outcomes require cross-divisional communication, cooperation, and engagement. Our individual office silos are crumbling. And with them is going the luxury of not having to read CC'd emails from the marketing department or from human resources or from some ad hoc deal with a certain issue committee. Our jobs keep changing. The disintegrating edges of our projects and our work in general would be challenging enough for anyone, but now we must add to that equation the constantly shifting definition of our jobs. I often ask in my seminars, which of you are doing only what you were hired to do? Seldom do I get a raised hand. As amorphous as edgeless work may be, if you had the chance to stick with some specifically described job long enough, you'd probably figure out what you needed to do, how much at what level to stay sane. But few have that luxury anymore, for two reasons. One, the organizations we're involved with seem to be in constant morph mode with ever-changing goals, products, partners, customers, markets, technologies, and owners. These all, by necessity, shake up structures, forms, roles, and responsibilities. Two, the average professional is more of a free agent these days than ever before, changing careers as often as his or her parents once changed jobs. Even 40-somethings and 50-somethings hold to standards of continual growth. Their aims are just more integrated into the mainstream now, covered by the catch-all, quote, professional management and executive development, unquote, which simply means they won't keep doing what they're doing for any extended period of time. Little seems clear for very long anymore, as far as what our work is and what or how much input may be relevant to doing it well. We're allowing in huge amounts of information and communication from the outer world, and generating an equally large volume of ideas and agreements with ourselves and others from our inner world. And we haven't been well equipped to deal with this huge number of internal and external commitments. The old models and habits are insufficient. Neither our standard education, nor traditional time management models, nor the plethora of organizing tools available, such as personal notebook planners, Microsoft Outlook, or PDAs, has given us a viable means of meeting the new demands placed on us. If you've tried to use any of these processes or tools, you've probably found them unable to accommodate the speed, complexity, and changing priority factors inherent in what you're doing. The ability to be successful, relaxed, and in control during these fertile but turbulent times demands new ways of thinking and working. There is a great need for new methods, technologies, and work habits to help us get on top of our world. The traditional approaches to time management and personal organization were useful in their time. They provided helpful reference points for a workforce that was just emerging from an industrial assembly line modality into a new kind of work that included choices about what to do and discretion about when to do it. When time itself turned into a work factor, personal calendars became a key work tool. Even as late as the 1980s, many professionals considered having a pocket day timer the essence of being organized. And many people today think of their calendar as the central tool for being in control. Along with discretionary time also came the need to make good choices about what to do. ABC priority codes and daily to-do list were key techniques that people developed to help them sort through their choices in some meaningful way. If you had the freedom to decide what to do, you also had the responsibility to make good choices, given your, quote, priorities, unquote. What you've probably discovered, at least at some level, is that a calendar, though important, can really effectively manage only a small portion of what you need to organize. And daily to-do lists and simplified priority coding have proven inadequate to deal with the volume and variable nature of the average professional's workload. More and more people's jobs are made up of dozens or even hundreds of emails a day, with no latitude left to ignore a single request, complaint, or order. There are few people who can, or even should, expect to code everything an A, a B, or a C priority, or who can maintain some predetermined list of to-dos that the first telephone call or interruption from their boss won't totally undo. The big picture versus the nitty-gritty. At the other end of the spectrum, a huge number of business books, models, seminars, and gurus have championed the bigger view as the solution to dealing with our complex world. Clarifying major goals and values, so the thinking goes, gives order, meaning, and direction to our work. In practice, however, the well-intentioned exercise of values thinking too often does not achieve its desired results. I've seen too many of these efforts fail for one or more of the following three reasons. 1. There's too much distraction at the day-to-day, hour-to-hour level of commitments to allow for appropriate focus on the higher levels. 2. Ineffective personal organizational systems create huge subconscious resistance to undertaking even bigger projects and goals that will likely not be managed well, and that will in turn cause even more distraction and stress. 3. When loftier levels and values actually are clarified, it raises the bar of our standards, making us notice that much more that needs changing. We're already having a serious negative reaction to the overwhelming number of things we have to do. And what created much of the work that's on those lists in the first place? Our values. Focusing on primary outcomes and values is a critical exercise, certainly, but it does not mean there is less to do or fewer challenges in getting the work done. Quite the contrary, it just ups the ante in the game, which still must be played day to day. For a human resources executive, for example, deciding to deal with quality of work-life issues in order to attract and keep key talent does not make things simpler. There has been a missing piece in our new culture of knowledge work, a system with a coherent set of behaviors and tools that functions effectively at the level at which work really happens. It must incorporate the results of big-picture thinking as well as the smallest of open details. It must manage multiple tiers of priorities. It must maintain control over hundreds of new inputs daily. It must save a lot more time and effort than are needed to maintain it. It must make it easier to get things done. The promise, the ready state of the martial artist. Reflect for a moment on what it actually might be like if your personal management situation were totally under control at all levels and at all times. What if you could dedicate fully 100% of your attention to whatever was at hand, at your own choosing, with no distraction? It is possible. There is a way to get a grip on it all, stay relaxed, and get meaningful things done with minimal effort across the whole spectrum of your life and work. You can experience what the martial artists call a mind like water, and top athletes refer to as the zone, within the complex world in which you're engaged. In fact, you've probably already been in this state from time to time. It's a condition of working, doing, and being in which the mind is clear and constructive things are happening. It's a state that is accessible by everyone and one that is increasingly needed to deal effectively with the complexity of life in the 21st century. More and more, it will be a required condition for high-performance professionals who wish to maintain balance and a consistent positive output in their work. World-class rower Craig Lambert has described how it feels in his book, Mind Over Water. Rowers have a word for this frictionless state, swing. Recall the pure joy of riding on a backyard swing, an easy cycle of motion, the momentum coming from the swing itself. The swing carries us. We do not force it. We pump our legs to drive our arc higher, but gravity does most of the work. We are not so much swinging as being swung. The boat swings you. The shell wants to move fast. Speed sings in its lines in nature. Our job is simply to work with the shell, to stop holding it back with our thrashing struggles to go faster. Trying too hard sabotages boat speed. Trying becomes striving, and striving undoes itself. Social climbers strive to be aristocrats, but their efforts prove them no such thing. Aristocrats do not strive. They have already arrived. Swing is a state of arrival. The mind-like-water simile. In karate, there is an image that's used to define the position of perfect readiness, mind-like-water. Imagine throwing a pebble into a still pond. How does the water respond? The answer is, totally appropriately to the force and mass of the input. Then it returns to calm. It doesn't overreact or underreact. The power in a karate punch comes from speed, not muscle. It comes from a focused pop at the end of the whip. That's why petite people can learn to break boards and bricks with their hands. It doesn't take calluses or brute strength, just the ability to generate a focused thrust with speed. But a tense muscle is a slow one. So the high levels of training in the martial arts teach and demand balance and relaxation as much as anything else. Clearing the mind and being flexible are key. Anything that causes you to overreact or underreact can control you, and often does. Responding inappropriately to your email, your staff, your projects, your unread magazines, your thoughts about what you need to do, your children, or your boss will lead to less effective results than you'd like. Most people give either more or less attention to things than they deserve, simply because they don't operate with a mind like water. Can you get into your productive state when required? Think about the last time you felt highly productive. You probably had a sense of being in control. You were not stressed out. You were highly focused on what you were doing. Time tended to disappear. Geez, at lunchtime already? And you felt you were making noticeable progress toward a meaningful outcome. Would you like to have more such experiences? And if you get seriously far out of that state and start to feel out of control, stressed out, unfocused, bored, and stuck, do you have the ability to get yourself back into it? That's where the methodology of getting things done will have the greatest impact on your life, by showing you how to get back to mind like water with all your resources and faculties functioning at a maximum level. The principle, dealing effectively with internal commitments. A basic truism I've discovered over 20 years of coaching and training is that most of the stress people experience comes from inappropriately managed commitments they make or accept. Even those who are not consciously stressed out will invariably experience greater relaxation, better focus, and increased productive energy when they learn more effectively to control the open loops of their lives. You've probably made many more agreements with yourself than you realize, and every single one of them, big or little, is being tracked by a less-than-conscious part of you. These are the incompletes, or open loops, which I define as anything pulling at your attention that doesn't belong where it is, the way it is. Open loops can include everything from really big to-do items like end world hunger, to the more modest, hire new assistant, to the tiniest task such as replace electric pencil sharpener. It's likely that you also have more internal commitments currently in play than you're aware of. Consider how many things you feel even the smallest amount of responsibility to change, finish, handle, or do something about. You have a commitment, for instance, to deal in some way with every new communication landing in your email, on your voicemail, and in your in-basket. And surely there are numerous projects that you sense need to be defined in your areas of responsibility, as well as goals and directions to be clarified, a career to be managed, and life in general to be kept in balance. You've accepted some level of internal responsibility for everything in your life and work that represents an open loop of any sort. In order to deal effectively with all of that, you must first identify and collect all those things that are ringing your bell in some way and then plan how to handle them. That may seem like a simple thing to do, but in practice, most people don't know how to do it in a consistent way. The basic requirements for managing commitments. Managing commitments well requires the implementation of some basic activities and behaviors. First of all, if it's on your mind isn't clear. Anything you consider unfinished in any way must be captured in a trusted system outside your mind, or what I call a collection bucket, that you know you'll come back to regularly and sort through. Second, you must clarify exactly what your commitment is and decide what you have to do, if anything, to make progress toward fulfilling it. Third, once you've decided on all the actions you need to take, you must keep reminders of them organized in a system you review regularly. An important exercise to test this model. I suggest that you write down the project or situation that is most on your mind at this moment. What most bugs you, distracts you, or interests you, or in some other way consumes a large part of your conscious attention? It may be a project or a problem that is really in your face, something you're being pressed to handle, or a situation you feel you must deal with sooner rather than later. Maybe you have a vacation trip coming up that you need to make some major last-minute decisions about. Or perhaps you just inherited $6 million and you don't know what to do with the cash. Whatever. Got it? Good. Now describe in a single written sentence your intended successful outcome for this problem or situation. In other words, what would need to happen for you to check this project off as done? It could be as simple as take the Hawaii vacation, handle situation with customer X, resolve college situation with Susan, clarify new divisional management structure, or implement new investment strategy. All clear? Great. Now write down the very next physical action required to move the situation forward. If you had nothing else to do in your life but get closure on this, where would you go right now and what visible action would you take? Would you pick up a phone and make a call? Go to your computer and write an email? Sit down with pen and paper and brainstorm about it? Talk face-to-face with your spouse, your secretary, your attorney, or your boss? Buy nails at the hardware store? What? Got the answer to that? Good. Was there any value for you in these 2 minutes of thinking? If you're like the vast majority of people who complete that drill during my seminars, you'll be experiencing at least a tiny bit of enhanced control, relaxation, and focus. You'll also be feeling more motivated to actually do something about that situation you've merely been thinking about till now. Imagine that motivation magnified 1,000-fold as a way to live and work. If anything at all positive happened for you in this little exercise, think about this. What changed? What happened to create that improved condition within your own experience? The situation itself is no further along, at least in the physical world. It's certainly not finished yet. What probably happened is that you acquired a clearer definition of the outcome desired and the next action required. But what created that? The answer is thinking. Not a lot, just enough to solidify your commitment and the resources required to fulfill it. The real work of knowledge work. Welcome to the real-life experience of knowledge work and a profound operational principle. You have to think about your stuff more than you realize, but not as much as you're afraid you might. As Peter Drucker has written, quote, in knowledge work, the task is not given. It has to be determined. What are the expected results from this work is the key question in making knowledge workers productive, and it is a question that demands risky decisions. There is usually no right answer. There are choices instead. And results have to be clearly specified if productivity is to be achieved, unquote. Most people have a resistance to initiating the burst of energy that it will take to clarify the real meaning for them of something they have let into their world and to decide what they need to do about it. We're never really taught that we have to think about our work before we can do it. Much of our daily activity is already defined for us by the undone and unmoved things staring at us when we come to work or by the family to be fed, the laundry to be done, or the children to be dressed at home. Thinking in a concentrated manner to define desired outcomes is something few people feel they have to do. But in truth, outcome thinking is one of the most effective means available for making wishes reality. Why things are on your mind. Most often, the reason something is on your mind is that you want it to be different than it currently is, and yet you haven't clarified exactly what the intended outcome is, you haven't decided what the very next physical action step is, and/or you haven't put reminders of the outcome and the action required in a system you trust. That's why it's on your mind. Until those thoughts have been clarified and those decisions made, and the resulting data has been stored in a system that you absolutely know you will think about as often as you need to, your brain can't give up the job. You can fool everyone else, but you can't fool your own mind. It knows whether or not you've come to the conclusions you need to, and whether you've put the resulting outcomes and action reminders in a place that can be trusted to resurface appropriately within your conscious mind. If you haven't done those things, it won't quit working overtime. Even if you've already decided on the next step you'll take to resolve a problem, your mind can't let go until and unless you write yourself a reminder in a place it knows you will without fail look. It will keep pressuring you about that untaken next step, usually when you can't do anything about it, which will just add to your stress. Your mind doesn't have a mind of its own. At least a portion of your mind is really kind of stupid in an interesting way. If it had any innate intelligence, it would remind you of the things you needed to do only when you could do something about them. Do you have a flashlight somewhere with dead batteries in it? When does your mind tend to remind you that you need new batteries? When you notice the dead ones. That's not very smart. If your mind had any innate intelligence, it would remind you about those dead batteries only when you passed live ones in a store, and ones of the right size to boot. Between the time you woke up today and now, did you think of anything you needed to do you still haven't done? Have you had that thought more than once? Why? It's a waste of time and energy to keep thinking about something that you make no progress on, and it only adds to your anxieties about what you should be doing and aren't. It seems that most people let their minds run a lot of the show, especially where the too much to do syndrome is concerned. You've probably given over a lot of your stuff, a lot of your open loops, to an entity on your inner committee that is incapable of dealing with those things effectively the way they are, your mind. The transformation of stuff. Here's how I define stuff. Anything you've allowed into your psychological or physical world that doesn't belong where it is, but for which you haven't yet determined the desired outcome and the next action step. The reason most organizing systems haven't worked for most people is that they haven't yet transformed all the stuff they're trying to organize. As long as it's still stuff, it's not controllable. Most of the to-do lists I've seen over the years, when people had them at all, were merely listings of stuff, not inventories of the resultant real work that needed to be done. They were partial reminders of a lot of things that were unresolved and as yet untranslated into outcomes and actions. That is, the real outlines and details of what the list makers had to do. Stuff is not inherently a bad thing. Things that command our attention, by their very nature, usually show up as stuff. But once stuff comes into our lives and work, we have an inherent commitment to ourselves to define and clarify its meaning. That's our responsibility as knowledge workers. If stuff were already transformed and clear, our value, other than physical labor, would probably not be required. At the conclusion of one of my seminars, a senior manager of a major biotech firm looked back at the to-do list she'd come in with and said, "Boy, that was an amorphous blob of undoability." That's the best description I've ever heard of what passes for organizing lists in most personal systems. The vast majority of people have been trying to get organized by rearranging incomplete lists of unclear things. They haven't yet realized how much and what they need to organize in order to get the real payoff. They need to gather everything that requires thinking about and then do that thinking if their organizational efforts are to be successful. The process, managing action. You can train yourself, almost like an athlete, to be faster, more responsive, more proactive, and more focused in knowledge work. You can think more effectively and manage the results with more ease and control. You can minimize the loose ends across the whole spectrum of your work life and personal life and get a lot more done with less effort. And you can make front-end decision-making about all the stuff you collect and create standard operating procedure for living and working in this new millennium. Before you can achieve any of that, though, you'll need to get in the habit of keeping nothing on your mind. And the way to do that, as we've seen, is not by managing time, managing information, or managing priorities. After all, you don't manage 5 minutes and wind up with six. You don't manage information overload, otherwise you'd walk into a library and die, or the first time you connected to the web or even opened a phone book, you'd blow up. And you don't manage priorities, you have them. Instead, the key to managing all of your stuff is managing your actions. Managing action is the prime challenge. What you do with your time, what you do with information, and what you do with your body and your focus relative to your priorities, those are the real options to which you must allocate your limited resources. The real issue is how to make appropriate choices about what to do at any point in time. The real issue is how we manage actions. That may sound obvious. However, it might amaze you to discover how many next actions for how many projects and commitments remain undetermined by most people. It's extremely difficult to manage actions you haven't identified or decided on. Most people have dozens of things that they need to do to make progress on many fronts, but they don't yet know what they are. And the common complaint that I don't have time to fill in the blank is understandable because many projects seem overwhelming and are overwhelming because you can't do a project at all. You can only do an action related to it. Many actions require only a minute or two in the appropriate context to move a project forward. In training and coaching thousands of professionals, I've found that lack of time is not the major issue for them, though they themselves may think it is. The real problem is a lack of clarity and definition about what a project really is and what the associated next action steps required are. Clarifying things on the front end when they first appear on the radar rather than on the back end after trouble has developed allows people to reap the benefits of managing action. The value of a bottom-up approach. I've discovered over the years the practical value of working on personal productivity improvement from the bottom up, starting with the most mundane ground floor level of current activity and commitments. Intellectually, the most appropriate way ought to be to work from the top down, first uncovering personal and corporate missions, then defining critical objectives, and finally focusing on the details of implementation. The trouble is, however, that most people are so embroiled in commitments on a day-to-day level that their ability to focus successfully on the larger horizon is seriously impaired. Consequently, a bottom-up approach is usually more effective. Getting current on and in control of what's in your in-basket and on your mind right now, and incorporating practices that can help you stay that way, will provide the best means of broadening your horizons. A creative, buoyant energy will be unleashed that will better support your focus on new heights, and your confidence will increase to handle what that creativity produces. An immediate sense of freedom, release, and inspiration naturally comes to people who roll up their sleeves and implement this process. You'll be better equipped to undertake higher-focused thinking when your tools for handling the resulting actions for implementation are part of your ongoing operational style. There are more meaningful things to think about than your in-basket, but if your management of that level is not as efficient as it could be, it's like trying to swim in baggy clothing. Many executives I've worked with during the day to clear the decks of their mundane stuff have spent the following evening having a stream of ideas and visions about their company and their future. This happens as an automatic consequence of unsticking their workflow. Horizontal and vertical action management. You need to control commitments, projects, and actions in two ways, horizontally and vertically. Horizontal control maintains coherence across all the activities in which you're involved. Imagine your psyche constantly scanning your environment like police radar. It may land on any of a thousand different items that invite or demand your attention during any 24-hour period. The drugstore, the housekeeper, your Aunt Martha, the strategic plan, lunch, a wilting plant in the office, an upset customer, shoes that need shining. You have to buy stamps, deposit that check, make the hotel reservation, cancel a staff meeting, see a movie tonight. You might be surprised at the volume of things you actually think about and have to deal with just in one day. You need a good system that can keep track of as many of them as possible, supply required information about them on demand, and allow you to shift your focus from one thing to the next quickly and easily. Vertical control, in contrast, manages thinking up and down the track of individual topics and projects. For example, your inner police radar lands on your next vacation as you and your spouse talk about it over dinner, where and when you'll go, what you'll do, how to prepare for the trip, and so on. Or you and your boss need to make some decisions about the new departmental reorganization you're about to launch. Or you just need to get your thinking up to date on the customer you're about to call. This is project planning in the broad sense. It's focusing in on a single endeavor, situation, or person, and fleshing out whatever ideas, details, priorities, and sequences of events may be required for you to handle it, at least for the moment. The goal for managing horizontally and vertically is the same, to get things off your mind and to get things done. Appropriate action management lets you feel comfortable and in control as you move through your broad spectrum of work and life, while appropriate project focusing gets you clear about and on track with the specifics needed. The major change, getting it all out of your head. There is no real way to achieve the kind of relaxed control I'm promising if you keep things only in your head. As you'll discover, the individual behaviors described in this book are things you're already doing. The big difference between what I do and what others do is that I capture and organize 100% of my stuff in and with objective tools at hand, not in my mind. And that applies to everything, little or big, personal or professional, urgent or not. Everything. I'm sure that at some time or other you've gotten to a place in a project or in your life where you just had to sit down and make a list. If so, you have a reference point for what I'm talking about. Most people, however, do that kind of list-making drill only when the confusion gets too unbearable and they just have to do something about it. They usually make a list only about the specific area that's bugging them. But if you made that kind of review a characteristic of your ongoing life and work style, and you maintained it across all areas of your life, not just the most urgent, you'd be practicing the kind of black belt management style I'm describing. I try to make intuitive choices based on my options instead of trying to think about what those options are. I need to have thought about all of that already and captured the results in a trusted way. I don't want to waste time thinking about things more than once. That's an inefficient use of creative energy and a source of frustration and stress. And you can't fudge this thinking. Your mind will keep working on anything that's still in that undecided state. But there's a limit to how much unresolved stuff it can contain before it blows a fuse. The short-term memory part of your mind, the part that tends to hold all of the incomplete, undecided, and unorganized stuff, functions much like RAM on a personal computer. Your conscious mind, like the computer screen, is a focusing tool, not a storage place. You can think about only two or three things at once. But the incomplete items are still being stored in the short-term memory space. And as with RAM, there's limited capacity. There's only so much stuff you can store in there and still have that part of your brain function at a high level. Most people walk around with their RAM bursting at the seams. They're constantly distracted, their focus disturbed by their own internal mental overload. For example, in the last few minutes, has your mind wandered off into some area that doesn't have anything to do with what you're hearing here? Probably. And most likely where your mind went was to some open loop, some incomplete situation that you have some investment in. All that situation did was rear up out of the RAM part of your brain and yell at you internally. And what did you do about it? Unless you wrote it down and put it in a trusted bucket that you know you'll review appropriately sometime soon, more than likely you worried about it. Not the most effective behavior. No progress was made, and tension was increased. The big problem is that your mind keeps reminding you of things when you can't do anything about them. It has no sense of past or future. That means that as soon as you tell yourself that you need to do something and store it in your RAM, there's a part of you that thinks you should be doing that something all the time. Everything you've told yourself you ought to do, it thinks you should be doing right now. Frankly, as soon as you have two things to do stored in your RAM, you've generated personal failure because you can't do them both at the same time. This produces an all-pervasive stress factor whose source can't be pinpointed. Most people have been in some version of this mental stress state so consistently for so long that they don't even know they're in it. Like gravity, it's ever present, so much so that those who experience it usually aren't even aware of the pressure. The only time most of them will realize how much tension they've been under is when they get rid of it and notice how different they feel. Can you get rid of that kind of stress? You bet. The rest of this book will explain how. Chapter 2. Getting Control of Your Life, The 5 Stages of Mastering Workflow. The core process I teach for mastering the art of relaxed and controlled knowledge work is a 5-stage method for managing workflow. No matter what the setting, there are 5 discrete stages that we go through as we deal with our work. We, 1, collect things that command our attention, 2, process what they mean and what to do about them, and 3, organize the results, which we, 4, review as options for what we choose to, 5, do. This constitutes the management of the horizontal aspect of our lives, incorporating everything that has our attention at any time. The method is straightforward enough in principle, and it is generally how we all go about our work in any case, but in my experience, most people can stand significantly to improve their handling of each of the 5 stages. The quality of our workflow management is only as good as the weakest link in this 5-phase chain, so all the links must be integrated together and supported with consistent standards. Most people have major leaks in their collection process. Many have collected things but haven't processed or decided what action to take about them. Others make good decisions about their stuff in the moment, but lose the value of that thinking because they don't efficiently organize the results. Still others have good systems but don't review them consistently enough to keep them functional. Finally, if any one of these links is weak, what someone is likely to choose to do at any point in time may not be the best option. The dynamics of these 5 stages need to be understood, and good techniques and tools implemented to facilitate their functioning at an optimal level. I found it very helpful, if not essential, to separate these stages as I move through my day. There are times when I want only to collect input and not decide what to do with it yet. At other times, I may just want to process my notes from a meeting, or I may have just returned from a big trip and need to distribute and organize what I collected and processed on the road. Then there are times when I want to review the whole inventory of my work or some portion of it. And obviously, a lot of my time is spent merely doing something that I need to get done. I've discovered that one of the major reasons many people haven't had a lot of success with getting organized is simply that they've tried to do all 5 phases at one time. Most, when they sit down to make a list, are trying to collect the most important things in some order that reflects priorities and sequences, without setting out many or any real actions to take. But if you don't decide what needs to be done about your secretary's birthday, because it's, quote, not that important, unquote, right now, that open loop will take up energy and prevent you from having a totally effective, clear focus on what is important. This chapter explains the 5 phases in detail. Chapters 4 through 8 provide a step-by-step program for implementing an airtight system for each phase, with lots of examples and best practices. Collect. It's important to know what needs to be collected and how to collect it most effectively so you can process it appropriately. In order for your mind to let go of the lower-level task of trying to hang on to everything, you have to know that you have truly captured everything that might represent something you have to do, and that at some point in the near future, you will process and review all of it. Gathering 100% of the incompletes. In order to eliminate holes in the bucket, you need to collect and gather together placeholders for, or representations of, all the things you consider incomplete in your world. That is, anything personal or professional, big or little, of urgent or minor importance, that you think ought to be different than it currently is, and that you have any level of internal commitment to changing. Many of the things you have to do are being collected for you as you read this. Mail is coming into your mailbox. Memos are being routed to your in-basket. Email is being funneled into your computer. And messages are accumulating in your voicemail. But at the same time, You've been collecting things in your environment and in your psyche that don't belong where they are, the way they are, for all eternity. Even though it may not be as obviously in your face as your email, this stuff still requires some kind of resolution, a loop to be closed, something to be done. Strategy ideas loitering on a legal pad in a stack on your credenza. Dead gadgets in your desk drawers that need to be fixed or thrown away. And out-of-date magazines on your coffee table all fall into this category of stuff. As soon as you attach a should, need to, or ought to an item, it becomes an incomplete. Decisions you still need to make about whether or not you're going to do something, for example, are already incompletes. This includes all of your I'm going to's, where you've decided to do something but haven't started moving on it yet, and it certainly includes all pending and in-progress items, as well as those things on which you've done everything you're ever going to do except acknowledge that you've finished with them. In order to manage this inventory of open loops appropriately, you need to capture it into containers that hold items in abeyance until you have a few moments to decide what they are and what, if anything, you're going to do about them. Then you must empty these containers regularly to ensure that they remain viable collection tools. Basically, everything is already being collected in the larger sense. If it's not being directly managed in a trusted external system of yours, then it's resident somewhere in your psyche. The fact that you haven't put an item in your in-basket doesn't mean you haven't got it. But we're talking here about making sure that everything you need is collected somewhere other than in your head. The collection tools. There are several types of tools, both low and high-tech, that can be used to collect your incompletes. The following can all serve as versions of an in-basket, capturing self-generated input as well as information coming from outside. Physical in-basket, paper-based note-taking devices, electronic note-taking devices, voice recording devices, email. The physical in-basket. The standard plastic, wood, leather, or wire tray is the most common tool for collecting paper-based materials and anything else physical that needs some sort of processing. Mail, magazines, memos, notes, phone slips, receipts, even flashlights with dead batteries. Writing paper and pads. Loose-leaf notebooks, spiral binders, and steno and legal pads all work fine for collecting random ideas, input, things to do, and so on. Whatever kind fits your taste and needs is fine. Electronic note-taking. Computers can be used to type in notes for processing later. And as character recognition technology advances, a parade of digital tools designed to capture data continues to be introduced. Handheld devices, personal digital assistants or PDAs, and electronic legal pads can both be used to collect all kinds of input. Auditory capture. Available auditory devices include answering machines, voicemail, and dictating equipment such as digital or microcassette recorders. All of these can be useful for preserving an interim record of things you need to remember or deal with. Email. If you're wired to the rest of the world through email, your software contains some sort of holding area for incoming messages and files where they can be stored until they're viewed, read, and processed. Pagers and telephones can capture this kind of input as well. Higher-tech devices. Now you can dictate into computers as well as handwrite into them. As more and more communication is morphed into digital and wireless formats, it will become easier to capture ideas, with a corresponding increase in the amount of data reaching us that we need to manage. Computer. Yes, David. I need bread. Yes, David. My needed grocery item has been collected, and as the organizing part of the action management process is further digitized, bread will automatically be added to my electronic grocery list and maybe even ordered and delivered. Whether high-tech or low-tech, all of the tools described above serve as similar in-baskets, capturing potentially useful information, commitments, and agreements for action. You're probably already using some version of most of them. The collection success factors. Unfortunately, merely having an in-basket doesn't make it functional. Most people do have collection devices of some sort, but usually they're more or less out of control. Let's examine the three requirements to make the collection phase work. 1. Every open loop must be in your collection system and out of your head. 2. You must have as few collection buckets as you can get by with. 3. you must empty them regularly. Get it all out of your head. If you're still trying to keep track of too many things in your RAM, you likely won't be motivated to use and empty your in-baskets with integrity. Most people are relatively careless about these tools because they know they don't represent discrete, whole systems anyway. There's an incomplete set of things in their in-basket and an incomplete set in their mind, and they're not getting any payoff from either one, so their thinking goes. It's like trying to play pinball on a machine that has big holes in the table so the balls keep falling out. There's little motivation to keep playing the game. These collection tools should become part of your lifestyle. Keep them close by so no matter where you are, you can collect a potentially valuable thought. Think of them as being as indispensable as your toothbrush or your driver's license or your glasses. Minimize the number of collection buckets. You should have as many in-baskets as you need and as few as you can get by with. You need this function to be available to you in every context, since things you'll want to capture may show up almost anywhere. If you have too many collection zones, however, you won't be able to process them easily or consistently. An excess of collection buckets is seldom a problem on the high-tech end. The real improvement opportunity for most people is on the low-tech side, primarily in the area of note-taking and physical in-basket collection. Written notes need to be corralled and processed instead of left lying embedded in stacks, notebooks, and drawers. Paper materials need to be funneled into physical in-baskets instead of being scattered over myriad piles in all the available corners of your world. Implementing standard tools for capturing ideas and input will become more and more critical as your life and work become more sophisticated. As you proceed in your career, for instance, you'll probably notice that your best ideas about work will not come to you at work. The ability to leverage that thinking with good collection devices that are always at hand is key to increased productivity. Empty the buckets regularly. The final success factor for collecting should be obvious. If you don't empty and process the stuff you've collected, your buckets aren't serving any function other than the storage of amorphous material. Emptying the bucket does not mean that you have to finish what's in your voicemail, email, or in-basket. It just means you have to take it out of the container, decide what it is and what should be done with it, and if it's still unfinished, organize it into your system. You don't put it back into in. Not emptying your in basket is like having garbage cans that nobody ever dumps. You just have to keep buying new ones to hold all your trash. In order for you to get in to empty, your total action management system must be in place. Too much stuff is left piled in baskets because of a lack of effective systems downstream from there. It often seems easier to leave things in when you know you have to do something about them but can't do it right then. The in-basket, especially for paper and email, is the best that many people can do in terms of organization. At least they know that somewhere in there is a reminder of something they still have to do. Unfortunately, that safety net is lost when the piles get out of control or the inventory of emails gets too extensive to be viewed on one screen. When you master the next phase and know how to process your incompletes easily and rapidly, in can return to its original function. Let's move on to how to get those in baskets and email systems empty without necessarily having to do the work now. Process. Teaching them the item-by-item thinking required to get their collection buckets empty is perhaps the most critical improvement I've made for virtually all the people I've worked with. When the head of a major department in a global corporation had finished processing all of her open items with me, she sat back in awe and told me that though she had been able to relax about what meetings to go to thanks to her trust in her calendar, she had never felt that same relief about all the many other aspects of her job, which we had just clarified together. The actions and information she needed to be reminded of were now identified and entrusted to a concrete system. What do you need to ask yourself and answer about each email, voicemail, memo, or self-generated idea that comes your way? This is the component of action management that forms the basis for your personal organization. Many people try to, quote, get organized, unquote, but make the mistake of doing it with incomplete batches of stuff. You can't organize what's incoming. You can only collect it and process it. Instead, you organize the actions you'll need to take based on the decisions you've made about what needs to be done. The whole deal, both the processing and organizing phases, is captured in the center trunk of the workflow diagram which you can see on the PDF file included with this program. In later chapters, I'll coach you in significant detail through each element of the process. For now, though, I suggest you select a to-do list or a pile of papers from your in-basket and assess a few items as we take an overview. What is it? This is not a dumb question. We've talked about stuff, and we've talked about collection buckets, but we haven't discussed what stuff is and what to do about it. For example, many of the items that tend to leak out of our personal organizing systems are amorphous forms that we receive from the government or from our company. Do we actually need to do something about them? And what about that email from Human Resources letting us know that blah blah about the blah blah is now the policy of blah blah? I've unearthed piles of messages in stacks and desk drawers that were tossed there because the client didn't take just a few seconds to figure out what, in fact, the communication or document was really about, which is why the next decision is critical. Is it actionable? There are two possible answers for this, yes and no. No action required. If the answer is no, there are three possibilities. One, it's trash, no longer needed. Two, no action is needed now, but something might need to be done later or incubated. Three,